And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Wall. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Tuesday evening. Kyle's actually in a different part of this massive room I'm in. He's just going to say hi for a second.
Hello.
And I'm going to continue and get into a parked car and talk about some of the things that we've done. But we're up here in the Pacific Northwest in Seattle now. We've been through Los Angeles. We've driven up the coast and having an interesting time, I'd say, overall.
Combined with a relaxing time.
Yeah. And Kyle's going to do some relaxing now because I'm actually recording this on Monday morning at a really late hour. In fact, I'm going to record the first half of this program before the Democratic convention starts, and then the second half after the first night, after Monday night, so that... I'm sorry, what?
Good luck.
Yeah, thank you for that. So kind of, I'd like to speak somewhat intelligently about what's going on at the DNC, because right now I can only surmise what might happen. I know Joe Biden is speaking on Monday. I believe Hillary Clinton is speaking on Monday, but I don't know how it went because it hasn't happened yet. So anyway, let me just get into this this car that's parked here so that I can have some soundproofing. Please bear with me. Okay, that's good. So we've been driving a lot, seeing various things. We saw part of an auto show in Monterey, California. We traveled through Portland. We drove up through Washington. Actually stayed in Vancouver. There's a Vancouver in Washington, and a lot of people don't know that. Right now we're in Seattle, and there's a sense that things are in the air as the DNC is about to start. A lot of posters up on various street signs. Some of it quite interesting. Here's an excerpt: pro-Israel, pro-genocide, and pro-rape, pro-Kamala Harris, and pro-Democrat equals pro-genocide and pro-rape. Yeah, there's a lot there. I could spend the next hour reading this pamphlet that's plastered to a lamppost, but there are many others with all kinds of things we can't say on the radio. But we can say this: in this house, we believe the American dream is a scam. Policing originates from runaway slave patrols. Capitalism exploits. Colonialism is evil. The founding fathers were racist. American imperialism must end. America was built on genocide and slavery. We are on stolen indigenous land. So, that's a sentiment that's being expressed. And, you know, you may agree, you may disagree, but it's expression and it's important. Now, here's another brochure on a different lamppost. Not all Kamala Harris supporters are genocidal white supremacists, but all of them decided genocide and white supremacy aren't deal breakers. That's something that is rather interesting. You'll probably see a bit of that in Chicago this week. Some demonstrations are scheduled to go through, as well they should. How Kamala Harris is complicit in Israel's Gaza genocide. They say abandon Harris, free Palestine, end U.S. support, Israel's 75-plus year occupation and genocide in Palestine, F liberal white supremacy. And again, you know, this is certainly an opinion that deserves to be heard. There's nothing in that particular statement that I can find that can be seen as anti-Semitic, but certainly anti-Israeli policy, and certainly very critical of what's been going on. The fact that we have to actually try and justify people being critical of a military operation that has left over 40,000 civilians dead, that to me is rather troublesome. So it's going to be an interesting week. It probably already has started to be an interesting week. And what we see here in Seattle, we see that that free expression being put forth, and you know, it's not a big deal to express yourself. It's a big deal to be a part of certain actions that result in a lot of death and destruction. And you have to question that. You absolutely have to question that. Now, I take exception with what was being said on some of these brochures saying abandon Harris and abandon white liberals or whatever you want to call them. You know, she's not a white liberal, really, is she? She's African-American. But whatever. The point is, if you abandon that particular side, well, what do you wind up with? It doesn't take much to figure it out. You wind up with Trump, okay? And if you have Trump, you know, you're going to have far worse scenarios than what you have right now. Now, you can call that agreeing that it's not a deal breaker or whatever the phrase was, but you could also call it choosing the lesser of two evils for a very good reason. You know, if there is one evil and there's another evil, and one evil is obviously much worse than the first evil, you're a fool not to choose the lesser of the two if you have the opportunity to do that. Otherwise, you're guaranteed to wind up with the worse of the two. And then how do you possibly have any chance of making things better? You know, we're talking about a guy who has pledged to bring federal troops into cities that are run by Democrats. In other words, a city has a Democratic mayor, like New York, like Chicago, like Los Angeles, like Seattle, like most cities, actually. Most big cities tend to be run by Democrats because, well, that's who most people tend to vote for, believe it or not. But you have somebody who is pledging to do that, to send federal troops into these cities. And, you know, this has happened before. It happened during the Rodney King riots. Federal troops came in at the request of the governor of the state. But what Trump is saying he will do is he will send troops in without that permission. He is pledging to do that. And he will do that to quell any kind of opposition to him, what he would consider to be a riot, to crack down on quote-unquote illegal immigration, to crack down on what he calls crime, etc., etc. Basically, whatever he wants to do. That is what he is pledging to do. All right? And if you're going to say there's no difference between him and someone who has not yet proven what she is going to do on the international stage, if you're just going to dismiss it all as all being the same, well, you're pretty much guaranteeing that we wind up with the far worse of the choices. Here at Stony Brook, we have some things to look forward to. Not this week, because school starts next week. School starts, I think, a week from yesterday, a week from Monday. And this story appeared in Newsday a couple of days ago, actually, August the 17th. After a summer hiatus, colleges and universities across Long Island are gearing up for the possible renewal of pro-Palestinian protests that fractured the Stony Brook University campus last spring and nearly led to the passage of a censure vote against the president. Okay, interesting thing. While that vote narrowly avoided being passed, the president resigned. Now, you know, we've seen this happen at Columbia University. We've seen it happen at a number of other institutions where the president of these institutions had to resign because of the way they dealt with the protests. Now, Stony Brook was no exception to that. The protests were handled very, very poorly, and the president resigned. But the official spin is that the president didn't resign because of that. She resigned because she took a better job at Yale. Okay, whatever you want to say, the fact of the matter is, virtually all these institutions where heavy-handed police crackdowns took place, the president resigned for one reason or another, and that is what happened at Stony Brook. Now, student leaders of the protest movement at Stony Brook said to Newsday they had no intention of backing off and planned to resume their demonstrations with the new semester. The student movement for Palestine at Stony Brook has grown rapidly. There is no threat great enough to silence us, the students said in a statement last Saturday, noting that Stony Brook and other SUNY schools divested from apartheid South Africa a few decades ago They believe a similar demand regarding Israel is within our reach. We will not slow down. Now, as the first day of classes nears on August the 26th, more than a dozen Jewish professors are calling for a reset at Stony Brook as an interim president takes over following the arrest of 29 of the protesters in May. They want a more open campus where demonstrators can freely express their views without fear of arrest or seizure of their cell phones. Now, let me just repeat that. This is a group of more than a dozen Jewish professors calling for a place where demonstrators can freely express their views and not have their cell phones seized. I mean, that says so much right there, that these professors can come together and issue that statement. And it basically completely disarms the argument that this is somehow an anti-Semitic a demonstration, people criticizing Israel, people being shamed and forced to not speak out. That is all nonsense. And we see so many examples of how people are intimidated into not expressing themselves because of what might happen if they do. That is extremely unhealthy. That is something any professor, any student should understand. And that is the real lesson here. Now, at the same time, some other Stony Brook professors are worried about the divisiveness returning to campus. They want the interim president, who's named Richard McCormick, to continue a security policy that they said helped fight anti-Semitism and provided a peaceful and safe environment for students. I must have missed that. When was that policy implemented? Because it sure wasn't implemented last spring, where the Suffolk County Police moved in and violently broke up protests. You know, these protests, I saw them firsthand. They were peaceful. People basically camped out in a particular part of campus. Now, they were told they couldn't have tents, so they camped out in sleeping bags. They were cooperating. What they wouldn't do, though, was transfer their protest to a different part of campus because another group, which happened to be a Jewish group of students, had planned something the next day. Now, admittedly, they had planned it in advance, but the nature of protesting is to disrupt the normal planning of things. So while it might not seem fair, it certainly could be seen as understandable. And if you have a situation where people are refusing to move, you don't have to resort to violence to deal with the situation. And I think it was a tremendous lost opportunity for students to come together and hear each other and listen and basically maybe sacrifice a space or trade it for another space or work it out in ways that people in the Middle East and people at the administrative level at Stony Brook and other places were unable to do. The students themselves had that chance. They still will have more chances like that in the future. It's a great way to teach those who are in charge what responsibility actually means. Anyway, the previous president left the university, as I mentioned, at the end of June for a job as president of Yale University. Her policy had called for arresting students who did not follow campus rules on protests. Again, protests are not meant to follow rules. That's what makes them protests. Now, it doesn't mean you can engage in destruction or violence or things that are obviously wrong, but simply being in a particular space, you know, it might be inconvenient, but it's not something that requires violent intervention to deal with. So, the new president sent a message to the university community last Wednesday, laying out his position. Now, while the protests in May were predominantly peaceful and largely free of the violence that disrupted many other universities, Stony Brook must ensure that the university remains unwaveringly committed to free speech and equally committed to providing everyone in our community with an environment free of discrimination. That's completely fair. He referred to the university's existing guidelines on how it handles protests, which state that free speech is permitted as long as it does not interfere with the school's operations or jeopardize the safety of anyone on campus. You know, it's a little tough to define what the school's operations actually are. You know, if a particular part of a sidewalk is blocked by demonstrators, yeah, I guess you are disrupting the school's operations, but you can walk around a different way. It's not the biggest deal in the world. Now, obviously, nobody should feel unsafe, but if basically somebody is defining feeling unsafe as having somebody demonstrate against a country that they support, I don't know if that really rises to the occasion of being made to feel unsafe. Now, there are other examples where somebody may directly feel unsafe and where things are being said or chanted that are unacceptable. And that's a different situation. Unfortunately, what we're seeing in many places is basically an assumption that people who are demonstrating in a particular way or for a particular cause, i.e. for Palestinians, or for a two-state solution, or anti-Netanyahu, or anti-Israeli military action, the assumption is that just by doing that, they are being anti-Semitic, or threatening, or a danger in some way, and must be dealt with. And that is extremely, extremely ill-guided and harmful, and anti-democratic. Now, Columbia University became an epicenter of the protests after students set up the first tent city back on April 17th. Last week, it started restricting access to its Morningside campus as it prepares for the start of classes on September 3rd. Only individuals with campus IDs and pre-authorized guests will be permitted on campus. Now, this supposedly is to keep people who are off-campus agitators from coming on campus and starting trouble, even though it was found that most of the people who were part of the demonstrations last spring were, in fact, students, and that people who were demonstrating from off campus were demonstrating off campus, like right off campus. So that's not necessarily the way to deal with that particular issue. Now, on Wednesday, Columbia's president, Nimet Shafik, resigned after 1 year in the post following widespread controversy on the campus over her handling of the protest. She called in the NYPD twice, with more than 100 students arrested. So not that different from Stony Brook at all. But it's interesting how she is being reported as having resigned because of this, whereas Stony Brook's president just went to Yale to get a better job. Okay, whatever. That's how things are being reported. The Columbia encampment inspired dozens of similar ones at colleges around the country, including at Stony Brook. About 2,500 protesters nationwide were eventually arrested. Disorderly conduct charges against the Stony Brook demonstrators were dropped in June by prosecutors. But a lot of disturbing things happened because of these protests in the way that demonstrators were dealt with. Their phones were seized by university police without warrants, and they were held on to for up to a week, I believe. And basically, Peter Brill was a lawyer representing the protesters. He contended that seizure was illegal. Stony Brook has stated it followed all legal procedures. Now, basically, everyone is saying that the new president, McCormick, has an opportunity to reset the dialogue, and people hope that that is what happens. I certainly do. It's a troubling situation, but what you have to understand is that it's an extremely troubling and an unacceptable situation for the people caught up in the middle of it. And these are innocent people by all definitions. It is unconscionable that we just simply turn our eyes away when we hear about yet another school or refugee camp being bombed by Israel, with dozens, if not more, civilians killed. And the reason is always, well, there was a terrorist there somewhere. You never get any more than that. You never get any more specific details. You know, you just basically have to trust them. And I don't think a lot of people trust these reports anymore. So obviously, you have to object to that. Now, I don't see people saying the state of Israel has to be destroyed. I don't see people saying anti-Semitic things, specifically anti-Semitic. Anti-Israel is not anti-Semitic. Anti-Netanyahu is not anti-Semitic. Criticizing or saying particular words in a particular way that you don't know is code for anti-Semitism, that is something that requires education. You know, from the river to the sea is not necessarily calling for the complete destruction of the state of Israel. It can be. Some people use it that way. Many people do not see it that way or don't see the significance. So it's important to at least try educating before condemning. And that is something that I hope we see more of in this coming school year. Now, the previous president at Stony Brook is gone, but some professors say they hope her security policies continue and that they are approaching the semester with trepidation. They feel the protest tore the campus apart and made Jewish students feel targeted with the chaos around them. They said some protesters used anti-Semitic language, so the protesters denied that. Should be easy. Should be easy to see. What did the protesters say? Was it anti-Semitic? You know, I never see the details. I never see the actual evidence. What is it they said that you consider to be anti-Semitic, and how do we deal with that? Instead, we're at a situation where people feel as if they are being targeted when actually it's the policies of a foreign country that are being targeted, that are being criticized, and it's our support for that, our engagement by sending additional arms to that regime to kill more innocent people. That is what is being attacked. It shouldn't be so hard. In fact, even our leaders are getting it. Joe Biden was starting to get it. Kamala Harris seems to be getting it as well. Are they getting it as fast as many people want them to? Of course not. But things move slowly. And, you know, I guarantee you that no matter who is in the White House, it could be Bernie Sanders, they would not be moving fast enough for many of us to be satisfied with. That's just the nature of America. So that's why it's foolish to simply condemn the Democrats and not condemn the Republicans, because keep in mind, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu basically agreed to exclude the Palestinians from further talks, alienate them even more, move the embassy to Jerusalem, do all kinds of things that were guaranteed to make the situation worse. And then when the situation finally became worse after Trump was voted out of office, well, it's easy to point the finger at Joe Biden and say it's all his fault. But that's not how it worked. That's not how it happened. Galia Lahav, a professor of political science at Stony Brook, said, "I am very worried. It was distracting, very divisive, and very unsettling, especially for me. I am Israeli." And I get that. I understand why it would be very worrisome. But what you have to understand is that what is happening over there is far, far worse. And of course, if you're part of a country that is doing horrible things to people, you might feel a little defensive about that. But what I see from so many people in the community is compassion and understanding of that. And that is what a college campus is about, to open up dialogue, to have people say things you don't expect from that particular person because they're from a particular background. You know, that is how we learn. That is how we progress beyond the same crap over and over, year after year. You know, it's sad to see it go that way all the time. Now, Lahav said she had just returned from a summer of volunteering in Israel, and that the pain of the people there is still raw after the October 7th terrorist attack. And I get that too. It was a horrible day. The things that happened, the savage attacks that took place, and again, you know, not to be completely unemotional about this, but that particular day, just as 9/11 was, it was a tremendous opportunity for the world to come together and condemn evil. And that did not happen because it was eclipsed by more evil. And so it became harder to say this is purely something that should never have happened, that must be condemned from all quarters, and that's it. That's end of. That's the final statement there. Unfortunately, what Israel has done since then is basically treat Palestinians as if they were subhuman and simply gotten away with whatever they felt like doing. Look, there's a situation in the West Bank that is ongoing, has been ongoing, involving what are known as illegal settlers. And the reason I call them illegal, you know, I shy away from that phrase because I don't believe people are illegal. Illegal immigrants, that's you don't categorize people in that way. But, you know, since the right-wing people like to do that, I'd like to basically take this one opportunity to say, okay, well, then the people who are kicking Palestinians out of their land in the West Bank and taking over their homes, taking over their land, and recognized by every international rights organization there is as illegal actions. Well, okay, let's call them illegal settlers. So what do we do about the illegal settlers in the West Bank? Yeah, you know, language can be an interesting thing when you basically define your terms in specific ways. And this is something that we don't think about. We don't care about. It adds to the frustration. It adds to the belief that you're not being heard. And I think this week in Chicago, you're going to see that bubbling over quite a bit. And it's going to seem unfair because the Democrats are part of this, but they're not the whole picture. They're not even half the picture. And if there's any hope of changing things, it has to lie with a more democratic regime than something that is simply going to impose its will by force. So anyway, this professor said she supported continuing the previous president's protest policies. I actually thought that the last president dealt with it very appropriately, given the circumstance. So we're hoping for that. I don't get this, though. What are you hoping for? More violence? More police crackdowns on people who are simply camping out in a particular spot? I mean, that is that tells me you're out of ideas. You're out of ways of even talking. And that makes you wrong, in my eyes, no matter what side you're on, if you're unwilling to talk to the people that are protesting. Now, again, you know, if people are protesting and destroying things or hurting people or just doing things that obviously are wrong and illegal, not simply camped out or sitting down or just being in the way. That is the whole point of a protest in the first place. Now, the pro-Palestinian protesters were demonstrating against the killing of thousands of civilians, tens of thousands of civilians, in the Gaza Strip during the conflict. Now, Israel has killed an estimated 40,000 people in Gaza. That's according to the Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry. And you might say, aha, Hamas is saying this. Yeah, but you know what? Nobody else has access. Nobody else can even get in there. Israel will not let journalists in there. So how do you even get any numbers? It's widely believed that the 40,000 number is much less than what the actual total is because there are so many people who are missing. Israel says the civilian deaths have been unwanted collateral damage of Israel's defense of itself as it fights to root out Hamas, which killed 1,200 people, again, in Israel on October 7th. But referring to individual people as collateral damage, wanted or unwanted, that is just cold. That is just uncivilized and barbaric. Now, in a statement on Saturday, the Stony Brook student leaders said that after the university refused to cut its economic ties with Israel, quote, we had no choice but to escalate our demonstrations, a successful tactic used by student activists on the right side of history generations before we were even born. They added that Stony Brook administrators used their authority to suppress students' rights to freedom of expression and that some had to spend a night in campus police headquarters while under arrest. Oh, campus police headquarters. I've been in that room. It's not pleasant. I thought they got transported to Suffolk County, but okay, they spent a night at campus police headquarters. Boy, sorry to hear about that. Now, some also were banned from campus for months. These are students. These are people that go to the campus, and you're banning them for speaking out against injustice. That is not right. Now, the former president said the students were arrested because they refused to move their tent encampment after multiple warnings, and that the university followed its stated guidelines for such violations. Well, first of all, they were sleeping bags. They weren't tents. I don't know. Maybe a couple of tents made it. It's not the ultimate crime. And okay, they refused to move. That's what happens sometimes. Can't you move around them? Can't you set up something in a different space? Must it wind up being a violent encounter? It doesn't make you look good when that's the solution. Now, in his message last Wednesday, the new president, McCormick, included a summary of existing rules on protest and said they would be enforced regardless of who is protesting. Although free speech is an essential part of university life, it does not extend to events and activities that impede university functions and operations, adding that Stony Brook has an unwavering commitment to the safety and security of all on campus. Sounds like more of the same to me, and I sure hope it doesn't go that way. But if it has to, then it has to, because people need to be able to express themselves without fear. Now, this brings us to something that's going on in Nassau County. That's the county a little bit to the west that's currently under a fascist dictator, which I don't want to talk about any more than I have to. But basically, their county executive, Bruce Blakeman, has recently pushed forward a law that makes it illegal to wear a mask in public except for medical or religious reasons. Okay, so, you know, this is not an attack on people with COVID, apparently, at least not for now. It's not an attack on people who are wearing face coverings for religious reasons. It is an attack on people who are demonstrating and don't want to be identified. Now, you might say, if you're going to demonstrate, you know, you should be able to show your face. You should have the courage to show your face. And on the surface, that sounds logical. But when you consider that what is happening to a lot of the people who do demonstrate, they are being identified. They are having their private information spread around. They are being intimidated. They are being stalked. They are being told they will never be hired by companies. They're being blacklisted. All this for criticizing Israel. Now, I'm sorry, but the country I grew up in, that is not something that any of us should expect. And, you know, that alone should be reason to criticize Israel. And I think if more people showed up and didn't wear masks, so that there were thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who said, no, this is too much. We are not going to tolerate this. Maybe that would have an effect, but for now, that's not happening. And that's why people feel compelled to wear masks, period. You know, a lot of cops wear masks, too. Why do they think they do that? Because if they don't wear masks, people figure out who they are, and they get harassed. We've already seen that pro-Israel demonstrators have no problem resorting to violence. We saw that at UCLA in the spring. Now, for some reason, those people were never charged. They were never arrested. They were never held accountable for the violence. But every news report said that there were violent protests that took place at UCLA. And that is how people remember it. And when you hear that violent protests took place at UCLA, who do you think instigated the violence? Sounds like the protesters, but it wasn't. It was not. If you saw the video, you saw that these people with sticks came and started beating the crap out of the people who were peacefully hanging out in their tent city that they made. So that is why people feel they have to protect themselves by simply masking their identity. Now, Nassau County has made it illegal, again, to wear a mask in public. So this means that if you are found to be wearing a mask, you will be arrested just for that. So you see, things are getting a little heated. They're getting a little controversial, and that's democracy. I hope this week we see more of that. We see people engaged in conversations. We see people engaged in protest. I hope we see that at Stony Brook. I hope we see that at universities around the country where people engage in actions and teach-ins and whatever they feel they need to do to get the word out and to establish a dialogue. That is what it should be all about. And what we saw up until the point of violence was healthy. And we need to all be involved in that in one way or another. And anyone who disagrees with that, you have to wonder what their motivations are to silence people, to keep them from talking or questioning. And anytime something of this magnitude happens in the world, no matter who it is, you need to question it. We all need to question it. All right, so I've talked enough about this. What I'd like to do is fast forward to Monday night after the first night of the Democratic National Convention, see what's happened so far. Because right now I'm talking on Sunday night and I'm woefully ignorant about what's actually happening. So let's transfer it to me in the future, which to you is still in the past. All right, well, it is now Monday night after the first day of the Democratic Convention. Boy, I got to say, that was something. That was an incredible day of a whole lot of speeches, a whole lot of really strong presentations by various people from Hillary Clinton to Jill Biden to Joe Biden, of course, and many, many others throughout the few hours of this first day. It's fascinating to watch. It's fascinating to see just how the race has changed in the past few weeks. Whereas before, everybody was kind of dreading the campaign ahead. Now I see this this real enthusiasm as Kamala Harris really ramps it up and people line up behind her to basically do battle with Donald Trump, who really seems to have lost his way as far as figuring out how to counter what has been going on. I'm looking at some of the responses tonight for the first night of the DNC from the Trump War Room on Twitter. All caps, reviews are in for day one of the DNC. And in quotes, with no attribution, it is fair to say that the Republicans had a tighter ship. I don't even know what that means. What are they talking about? We're talking about the presentation of their conference over this particular conference. I don't know. It's then they basically have to try and inject all kinds of conflict between people. Joe Biden gave a speech that started fairly late, like around 11:30 at night. And they're trying to conjure up some kind of disrespect that was thrown his way by making him start late and therefore not be in prime time. First of all, the convention is in Chicago, which is in central time, so 10:30 is in prime time. But I don't think he really cares about that. I don't think anybody even watches TV like that anymore. I think people are basically seeing it whenever they feel like it. And he gave his speech in full. And boy, the emotion behind that, somebody basically stepping down from the most powerful position in the world, saying that he loved the job, but he loved his country more, recognizing that him continuing to run would probably put the Democrats at a disadvantage, and that this was the way forward. And it really resonated. It really resonated seeing that happen, seeing his daughter introducing him, seeing his wife speak of him beforehand, seeing all the people paying tribute to him, and just the crowd. The crowd, it got kind of annoying for a while, all the chants that kept coming up. But I think it showed the world that this was, in fact, the right decision. And just, I don't know, the number of powerful people up there, particularly women, who were basically speaking out and inspiring the crowd. It really worked. It really worked. And, you know, in contrast, if we're going to compare conventions, the Republican convention was all about hatred. It was all about fear. It was all about demonizing various people, such as migrants people that were just different in one way or another, maybe trans people, all sorts of individuals that you could genuinely be afraid of. That was their programming. That was what they thought would work. Whereas the Democratic Convention so far, it's only been one day, they seem to be preaching inclusion and strength and change and positivity and human rights and voting and all kinds. I mean, you know, I don't think it's displaying a particular bias to say that that is a more positive, uplifting message. You know, it really does inspire you to hear people talk like that. And when you hear other people just talking about hatred and fear and negativity, it's not as inspiring. You know, it doesn't matter if you agree with them or not. It just isn't as good. Here's another tweet that Trump's campaign posted in the middle of Biden's speech. Crooked Joe went off script and said the Hamas rioters outside the DNC have a point. And then they're trying to force the issue by saying, what does Kamala have to say about that? Well, you know, like we were talking about earlier, the demonstrators outside do have a point. They should be heard. They should be demonstrating. They should be saying what's on their mind. But note the difference. Demonstrators, not Hamas rioters, but that is how the right wing likes to basically describe those people, by equating them with Hamas, when what they're saying is civilians should not be slaughtered as they have been over the past few months. That does not make you a Hamas sympathizer. However, if you're trying to rally people around you, portraying the other side as negative and violent, that's how you get people on your side. At least that's the Republican way of thinking. So it's, you know, it's a marked contrast, what we're seeing so far. I don't know what tonight will be like. The DNC night two begins right after this show ends. We work that out. And then there's Wednesday and Thursday as well. So it's fascinating to watch. And I do suggest people watch it. And, you know, my network of choice, and I know Kyle's network of choice, is C-SPAN, because they don't have a lot of people talking over the people who are talking to tell you what they're saying. They don't do that. They don't have commercials. And you basically get to see everything. Sometimes it's just a crowd of people, and you just hear the crowd of people for a half hour. That's fine, too. But it's what's really going on.
Yeah, the experience watching it through that channel is much calmer, I think.
It definitely is.
I hate to say it. I mean, I'm comfortable with the leadership in this and the energy. I don't really have anything to say. I don't mean that in like a apathetic way. Like, I'm fully like engaged. I care. Like, obviously, I'm still Kyle, but I'm fine with this. I don't think it needs me to say anything. This is the right trajectory. Like, I mean, pretty much everything coming from the other side speaks for itself and is weak. Like, the kind of propaganda and stuff from outside sources that is meant to mislead Americans and divide us doesn't really come through when Americans aren't dividing, when Americans have a common purpose. It galvanizes in a way that does not allow those kind of talking points through, whether it's like state positions from Israeli government or other positions that are suspiciously similar to the end goals of other nation states. Like, I find it refreshing that we get bad attacks that don't really land in a moment like this, because it just shows their weakness and basically how their numbers are dwindling, because this is the party that has a good time and is actually having a party.
It sure felt that way. It looked like they were having fun. It really felt that way. You know, I was watching speeches and they made me happy, you know, because you see people who have been struggling, you see people who have been fighting, and it feels like they're getting somewhere. It feels like they're being heard. It feels like they represent all of us in one way or another. You know, it doesn't matter what your race or religion or any of that is. It shouldn't have to matter. And when people who have been marginalized or not represented properly over the decades or centuries finally are having a voice and being represented and winning, that's a good feeling for all of us, you know. And I'm just getting this this really cranky response from Republicans that she's, you know, a DEI candidate, meaning someone who is hired solely because of her minority status. It's absurd. It's insulting. It's ignorant. And it can't stand. It really can. We have to move past this. We have to be better. I mean, look, I'm looking at another tweet now from Trump's campaign. It's like sixth graders are writing this. "Get the hell off my stage," quotes Kamala whispers. Did I just mispronounce her name the way they do? Oh my God, I'm reading the tweet like they wrote it.
Is it written that like with a dash?
No, I did that myself. Oh my goodness. Anyway, "Get the hell off my stage," Kamala whispers as Biden is discarded into the dustbin of history once and for all. My God. I mean, they're basically injecting drama that doesn't exist when everybody there was basically showing their profound appreciation for what Biden has accomplished and for the sacrifice he's made to basically hand the torch to Harris. And, you know, fingers crossed that that actually goes to a positive place and we get past all this negativity, ignorance, disinformation, you name it. It's really a little frightening because you realize how quickly it can happen, how quickly people can just wind up believing things that aren't true based on absolutely nothing. yeah, you know, I could just read through these ignorant comments that I'm seeing, but they're only coming from one place, only coming from the Trump campaign, who basically may seem to have lost their way. They really do, because they don't know how to attack Harris. They certainly don't know how to attack Walz, her vice presidential candidate. And, you know, and the more I see that guy, the more I like him. I see why she chose him. He is funny. He is on target. He is unapologetic. And he appeals to so many in the Midwest, so many in the middle class. I mean, for God's sake, the guy was a football coach and... you know, he's worked in so many different areas of America, governor of Minnesota, you know, all sorts of things that make him an interesting person. But he gets it. You know, he is not afraid to say what's on his mind and to fight back. And that's what Democrats have been lacking for so long, is that ability to fight back. So. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. It's going to be quite a interesting couple of months ahead of us, and we'll be updating people on that. Stepping away, though, from this, which is what we've been talking about, I recorded most of this show yesterday, and between yesterday and today being Monday night, and I know this show airs on Tuesday evening, in between, during that period, there was a massive storm that hit the area. And boy, it has caused all kinds of problems. We've seen a road in Stony Brook collapse. We've seen a dam break. We've seen all kinds of intersections become unusable.
Wait. I don't want to diminish the dam breaking, but it was for a pond. It wasn't like a dam, like with like three towns up downstream of it. It's still significant, and I'm sure a lot of habitats were destroyed. Shout out to the turtles and all the
there
animals.
There are turtles all over Stony Brook that were in that mill pond. The mill pond is completely drained now, and there's all kinds of, well, fish carcasses now, I guess. But, yeah, you might see some turtles in Stony Brook Village that really don't belong there. I didn't even know where to put them because I think the pond was freshwater, but it I don't know how it worked. It goes into salt water or something. It's confusing, but they're saying it's going to take years to fix this. Years. This is climate change. And then, you know, I see our representative, Nick LaLota, saying, hey, we have to get together and, deal with this emergency. This is a guy that backs the person who thinks climate change is a hoax. All right. And pretending that he cares about this at all, it's nonsense. And any politician that steps up or pretends to step up when a crisis finally hits caused by climate change, don't believe them. Don't give them the satisfaction of having them pretend to be a leader when in actuality, they do whatever they can to prevent programs that actually will fight climate change. This is a real emergency at this point. This is a crisis like everybody has been predicting. You know, we've talked about it on this show for years. Here it is. Now it's local. Now it's right down the block, all right? And we can't continue to even listen to these idiots who continue to say things like it's all a hoax or it's just the weather changing or anything like that. I mean, you know, Kyle and I have been gone for a couple of weeks now, maybe 3 weeks. And in that period, there have been three major storms. And the last one was simply unbelievable. Like things people have never seen in their entire lives. And all the predictions are that this is going to continue happening. And you're going to see houses falling into the sea. You're going to see roads eroded and destroyed. You're going to see all sorts of catastrophes and disasters and flooding like you just would not believe. And that's only one part of the country. That's only one part of the world. This is something that affects everyone. And it needs to be a major priority, if not the only priority, if we're going to continue to survive. So I guess that's a sobering note to end on. Any final remarks on that, Kyle?
I just would say, like, it need not be a pocket check on the average person. We know the firms that profited and lobbied for policies to be as they are. And yeah, like, you know, all the truck guys that bought bypass kits for their exhaust emissions, like, yeah, they can run spouting off about freedom and be idiotic to their heart's content. But real talk, eBay settled for $1 billion with the EPA over making those available kits like that available in the marketplace. So, like, yeah, like, it may have been allowed until it wasn't, and you're still damaging the air quality. And I think people should think about their individual actions, but the players upstream should be on notice and frightened for their lives, for their livelihood, for everything they've built up to insulate them from this. And I think the Piper is coming around and ready to get paid, because I mean the money's there. It's just whether it's going to be remediation or some undeserving profiteer's yacht. This is a class issue. Like, they made all this money selling people who had to get to their jobs in a car the cheap fuel or whatever for years, poisoning the air, increasing carbon levels, and we can tell ourselves that we need to have it be one way or the other until we're blue in the face or choking on soot. But it's not going to make it easier for the vast majority of us if we continue to fatten those profiteers. Like, let's talk about other systems and other ways of doing this and collective action around the kinds of purchases and kinds of decisions that are made, and not just blindly buy in because we're told we have to do it one way. Like, get a bicycle, do anything else.
And what Kyle says is so true and so impassioned and so important. But remember, we all as individuals can do something, but we have to make sure those that really, really have added to this problem are held accountable and that they do something. What's that, Kyle?
Tax private jets, like a lot more.
Of course, of course. There's so many other things that should be done. But look, we're out of time right now. The important thing is to speak up. Don't elect the people that facilitate this kind of nonsense and make it worse, because that just sets everybody back and results in all kinds of disasters and really bad time for everyone. If you're in Chicago, boy, this is a good thing to be demonstrating about. In fact, you know, I still think people should go. I'm going to play that song, aren't I? Yeah, okay, I think everybody should go to Chicago because the world's dying. Yeah, write to us, otw@2600.com. See you next week, Kyle.
I'll see you next week. I mean, a lot of this could have been 20 years sooner, but I'm glad it's happening at all.
Come to Chicago just to sing. In a land that's known as freedom, how can such a thing be fair? Won't you please come to Chicago for the help that we can bring? We can change the world. We are ready.
And you're listening to WUSB, Stony Brook, New York.